So to introduce the session today, one of the key questions facing many of us, and I know many of you in this room are involved in these pertinent wicked questions, why is state building so difficult? Why have we been working since at least the end of the Second World War on these endeavours and have fewer success stories to point at? I was recently at a conference at Wilton Park in the UK where the question of whether we need to rethink state building was the key theme, with about 80 thinkers from around the world on these topics gathering to debate some of the old and some of the newer questions. And despite the level of attendance and the expertise in the room, there remain no clear consensus or solutions. There is evidence that state building and stabilisation efforts often fail, and building legitimate institutions takes decades, and we're beginning to get better at talking about that and managing the expectations of politicians and decision makers along that track. State building is often misconceived as a brick building or gap filling exercise, and assumptions on what works often prove wrong. For instance, that service delivery itself and alone leads to legitimacy of the state and strengthens the state society compact. The process is therefore deeply contested, political and non-linear. All of that seems probably pretty obvious now with 70 years of practice. More than any other context or field, I'd argue, official guidance on state building seems highly disconnected from the reality on the ground. Those who are telling us how to think, how to approach it, are often not those in the field trying to make these things work. There are dozens of books and frameworks with abstract notions often of social contract or sovereignty gaps or political settlements, which are very difficult to translate into a programmatic context. And of course, support from development partners or donor countries, to use the old lexicon, has its own dilemmas. State building is a long-term process, yet projects really last more than about 3 to 5 years, one budget cycle. Serious challenges in understanding the local context exist, but donor officials cycle through in 3 years or less, and sometimes in my own department, a lot less. There are conflicting objectives in the mission: building the state, stopping terrorist groups, stability, ending violence, counter-narcotics, democratisation, business and investment interests. Many, many complex notions in themselves, but making them all work together in a way that delivers benefits for a wide range of stakeholders and creates the environment for a lasting peace is very tricky. So today we have three distinguished speakers who will present papers on various aspects of this topic. They're detailed in your program, but I will introduce them one by one. First, Sue Ingram from the Australian National University. Now, Sue helped to found the governance, fragility and conflict practice in the former Australian Agency for International Development. It saved me from more than one sticky situation when I was very new to the development business. Delighted to see that she's continuing to contribute here in this institution, also my alma mater, and continuing to talk and think on these very important issues. Sue, please.
Thank you. Great. Good morning, everyone. The research that I'm going to describe to you today set out to test the relationship, and that's very much, if indeed there is a relationship, between the character of a political settlement that's forged after conflict and the subsequent stability or instability of the state. And as Michael alluded, this research question is very much grounded in development policy. So let me explain that. Political settlements and the character of those settlements moved to the centre of state building policies from around 2010. The idea was picked up simultaneously by the OECD International Network on Conflict and Fragility, by the World Bank in its 2011 World Development Report, by UNDP, by the G7 Plus, and by a number of bilateral aid agencies, including the then AusAid. The policies these agencies advanced promoted the development of inclusive political settlements. And the premise was that an inclusive settlement is conducive to stability. But there was surprisingly little empirical work to back up this premise. And so in the best researcher tradition, I've set out to fill the gap. And the research was designed as a comparative case study, and I guess for the methodology wonks amongst you, because we were asked to describe our research methods, it's a most similar system design, where you take two cases that are very similar in their essential features, but differ on the dependent variable, in my case, stability and instability. And I use process tracing to explore the causal mechanisms for stability and instability and the possible contribution of the political settlement. And that's the end of methodology. The two cases are Timor-Leste and Bougainville. You can see where they are on that map. A unique map. They never appear in those together like that because of the way we carve up the Pacific. I selected the two of them as they do share significant similarities in ethnology and geography, in their mix of subsistence and minerals-based economies, and most importantly, as you'll see from my next slide, in their history and chronology of decolonisation, conflict and political settlement. But they then interestingly diverged in their subsequent experience of instability. Timor-Leste was seriously unstable after it became independent, but Bougainville, in contrast, has, after becoming an autonomous region, was seemingly very stable. However, this story became more interesting over the course of my research. The original contrast space on the dependent variable of stability and instability shifted. Timor-Leste found a path back to stability after its turbulent early years of statehood. And Bougainville is showing increasing signs of instability as the battle lines are drawn around the control of mining and the territory's political future. And this allowed a serendipitous within-case comparison for each of the case studies, increasing the number of observations that I could make. Sadly, I've got no time to go through the empirical data on the trajectories of the two political settlements, which is what's really interesting, but I'm going to move straight into the headline findings. And I'm going to start with the characterisation of the two political settlements and their trajectories. In Timor-Leste, a highly exclusionary political settlement took shape in the lead-up to independence. It concentrated power and rents in the hands of a small, unpopular faction. And in tandem, there was a progressive build-up of instability for several years in the lead-up to and following independence. And that exploded into a major political and security crisis in 2006. The security sector imploded, the capital was partitioned along ethnic lines, 650 houses were destroyed, 38 people were killed, and 15% of the population, that was 150,000 people, were displaced, and the Prime Minister was forced to resign, and a lot of other cabinet members also fell by the wayside, either in protest or because they were forced to leave. Under the new political leadership, rents were distributed very widely, and over time a broad-based elite pact emerged that effectively tamed politics, and Timor-Leste has been very stable since then. In Bougainville, a highly inclusive political settlement built up slowly and very much locally developed over several years with very little international agency. The centrepiece was a formula to share power between Papua New Guinea and Bougainville, and it involved immediate autonomy for Bougainville and a deferred referendum on independence. That formula was swiftly entrenched in the national constitution, in the constitution of Papua New Guinea, and then in the constitution that was specially crafted for an autonomous Bougainville government. And there's been no serious political instability of the type that's been seen in Timor-Leste, but stability is now looking increasingly precarious, with increasing contestation over the control of mining resources and mounting discord between Papua New Guinea and the autonomous Bougainville government, which threatens the viability of the autonomy referendum provisions that sit at the heart of the settlement. So taken together, the two cases offer clear insights into the causal mechanisms producing stability and instability, and the relationship to the character of the political settlement. And the dynamic is summarised on this next slide. In each of the case studies, the same two mechanisms recur as the drivers of instability, and they are serious elite splits and rent restriction. And the converse is also evident. Elite cooperation and rent sharing is conducive to stability. The causal mechanisms can be set in motion by an exclusionary political settlement. Where the settlement produces or intensifies elite splits and restricts rents, the grievances that flow from this become the actual drivers of instability. Excluded elites jockey to redirect power towards themselves, and they do that by quite unorthodox means as necessary. The restriction of rents is significant because it not only antagonises the excluded elites who aren't getting what they see as their share, but it also fuels the frustrations of the wider population, who in turn can be marshalled by the elites to demand a change in the settlement. And Timor-Leste is an exemplar of that pattern. The research demonstrates clearly that an exclusionary settlement can be a sufficient condition for instability. But in the best research tradition, more detailed case studies are necessary to generalise that an exclusionary settlement necessarily leads to instability. The two cases also show that as the elite dynamic and the distribution of rents shift over time, so too does instability or stability. So I guess the take-out message from this is that it's the outcome of the political settlement that really matters, rather more than the processes followed in producing it. And perhaps our focus should be less on the rather amorphous concept of inclusion than on the specifics of elite and, to a lesser extent, societal buy-in and rent distribution arising from the settlement. So let me now touch on several contextual factors that I identified through these cases that can up the ante and exclude the people who are excluded to press to broaden or appropriate power, or alternatively can moderate the forces of destabilisation. And the factors are set out on this slide. It's the prospect of major resource streams, the robustness of political institutions, both formal and informal, the capacity of governments to deliver public services, and the degree of commitment to the terms of the settlement. And I've got very little time available, so I can only touch on a couple of these. First, the availability of major resource streams, absolutely critical in both Timor-Leste and Bougainville. The two cases show clearly that the forces for destabilisation intensify where control over significant resources comes into play. In Timor-Leste, the activation of the petroleum-based sovereign wealth fund raised the stakes dramatically, as the government of the day would at last be able to pay the long-awaited peace dividend and shore up its very damaged legitimacy. And it meant that the opponents of the government had to unseat that government quickly or resign themselves to years in the political wilderness as a very high level of funding came on stream. In minerals-rich Bougainville, the autonomous government, the national government and several senior ex-combatant leaders and their foreign partners are currently at loggerheads over mining. In the decade following the conflict, several ex-combatant leaders based around Panguna Mine entered into lucrative alliances with foreign mining ventures, stitching up dubious exploration deals over expansive areas of land. And when the Momus government was elected in 2010, it introduced policies and then legislation which seriously jeopardised these irregular ventures. And those affected, who see the risk of losing out, have been working assiduously to discredit the Bougainville government and to draw the national government in as spoiler. The second factor I'll touch on briefly is the character of political institutions. And institutions do matter. Because institutions set the rules of the game, they create winners and losers. And the losers may be inspired to change the game, or to change the rules of the game, or to change the players. And I'll give you just one example of this. In Timor-Leste, the electoral system advocated by the UN Transitional Administration to form the Constituent Assembly significantly advantaged one political party, paving the way for that party to dominate the constitution-making process and to implement its own model of a pared-back semi-presidential system, and then to go on to form the government. The man who was destined to be president, the former resistance leader, found himself stripped of executive power, and so instead he relied on his charismatic authority to undermine the first-term government and to force a change in the prime minister. The two cases also provide good evidence that weak and ambiguous formal institutions are unable to contain political contestation, and that strengthened institutions are a bulwark against instability. Again, I've got no time to give you the examples, but they are convincing. And in the 2 minutes, one slide left, I wanted to look briefly at what constitutes inclusive or inclusive enough. And there are really several factors at work: the disposition or capacity of excluded actors to play the spoiler, the breadth and resilience of elite pacts, and societal satisfaction with the outcomes of the settlement. And again, I'm going to illustrate the spoiler factor with a comparison of Timor-Leste and Bougainville. In both cases, the leader of the armed resistance struggle was left on the margins of power in the political settlement, but the consequences were very different. In Bougainville, the leader of the resistance and his rump of followers rejected the peace process and withdrew to the no-go zone around Panguna Mine, but they made it clear at various points in the peace process that they didn't intend to spoil it, and indeed their capacity to do so was quite limited because the bulk of the population, exhausted by the conflict, was heavily committed to the political settlement process underway. In Timor-Leste, the leader of the resistance was not a man to be marginalised, and the population was behind him and was able to marshal a broad array of powerful actors and disenfranchised supporters who could destabilise the government. And I've got 1 minute left, so one more point. Just one more insight, I guess, coming out of the examination of political settlements and their nature. There's quite a debate in the grey literature about the competing characterisations of political settlements as events such as peace agreements or the framing of a constitution, or as continuing processes of bargaining. And my research would strongly support the view that settlements are dynamic and shifting, and our best insights into their effects come through tracking their evolution over time. And it also suggests that supporting inclusive political settlements, and I'd put in the caveat to the extent that development practitioners can do so, will be about continuing engagement and positioning within the changing political landscape. And I think that's it. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. There will be the opportunity at the end of the session for, I hope, quite a bit of time for questions and answers. So if anything that any of the speakers raise piques your interest in particular, please have your questions ready for them when we get into that session. Now our second speaker today is Hannah Early from Westmont College in the US. Her paper is entitled "The Hand That Gave Us Flour Now Gives Us Bombs: The Limited Effectiveness of US Aid in Israel-Palestine's New Legal Space." And this analysis assesses the impact of different forms of US aid on Israel-Palestine's justice systems. Hannah.
Hello, and thank you for having me today. My name is Hannah Early, and I am a research consultant in Santa Barbara, California, which is also the location of Westmont College, where I did this research through. If I have extra time at the end, I will look further at the... more closely and comment on the first portion of the title, but for now I'd like to suffice it to say that this is a quote from a Palestinian farmer describing the contentious role of U.S. aid in Israel-Palestine. My research focused on the effectiveness of U.S. aid to Israel-Palestine's justice systems, and as a way to introduce this topic, I'd like to talk about what is called the new legal space. And this is a major theoretical framework which I utilized in my research. In their work on the European Union's aid to Israel-Palestine, Anselm Khalil and Raffaella A. Del Sarto coined the term new legal space to describe the multiple overlapping jurisdictional boundaries and justice systems which coexist within Israel-Palestine. If you'll notice on the slide, there are, at this point in time, more than 9 overlapping legal systems which govern different segments of the population. Further, Khalil and Del Sarto utilize this term to argue that, given the complexity of Israel-Palestine's legal systems, it is both inaccurate and impractical to consider the justice systems in isolation when assessing justice sector reform projects. And so in my research, I affirm this position and make use of this framework to consider all of the ways that U.S. aid influences different segments of the new legal space, both indirectly and directly. To briefly address my research methodology, I utilized a 4-pronged impact assessment tool developed by researchers Ginsburg and Pengsa, which has previously been used to assess the impact of the European Union's security sector reform projects. The tool has multiple different metrics for each category, but for sake of time, I'm going to speed through that now. This is a case study of U.S. aid, and I looked at 3 different aid providers through the U.S. government. First, the U.S. Agency for International Development providing justice sector reform projects. Second, the Department of State with security sector reform projects. And lastly, the Department of Defense with their military aid package to Israel. And looking at all the different ways that these 3 aid agencies impact the new legal space. I'd be happy to answer questions about this, but we'll speed through for today. To spend most of the time on our findings. Broadly, I found that despite some positive functional effects on segments of Israel-Palestine's justice systems, the effectiveness of U.S. aid to the new legal space was limited by 4 factors. First, the instability of the political climate, the U.S.'s strategic relationship with Israel, the fragmentation of the justice systems, and the interferences between aid programs when operationalized. For the sake of time today, and because this is a portion of a much larger body of research, I will focus on the instability of the political climate and the U.S.'s strategic relationship with Israel as windows or vignettes into the larger trends in my findings. First, the instability of the political climate. So I want to look at today how the instability of the political climate limited or hindered the effectiveness of U.S. aid. One metric by which I measured functional impact was the extent to which aid programs achieved their preset goals and targets. Here we'll look at how political instability limited the ability for USAID in particular to achieve their goals and targets. During the 1996 to 2015 period, which is the period in which I conducted my research, or the period that I looked at for my research, all but one USAID project had to delay its start or to be put on hold for periods of 10 to 18 months due to political instability, ranging from the Al-Aqsa Intifada to more routine periods of violence. And during these cessation periods, project staffs had little to no ability to move forward on their project goals and oftentimes had to reset and greatly truncate their original goals and objectives for the project. Most notably, after the 2006 Hamas election victory in Gaza, USAID ceased all justice sector reform projects in Gaza and has yet to resume projects there. These cessations of programs for long periods of time is just one illustration or example or a window into how political instability has limited the effectiveness of U.S. programs. Other examples would be the movement and access issues across the West Bank and Gaza, as well as violence that has injured U.S. project staffs or damaged property. And those are important to take note of. Next, in looking at the political impact, amongst other metrics, I measured the extent to which programs achieved buy-in from domestic political actors. And I'll provide one example of the limitations due to political instability. Again, following the January 2006 Hamas election victory in Gaza, the U.S. government issued a no-contact order between U.S. aid officials and all Palestinian officials. After months of writing MOUs and working on confidence-building measures, U.S. aid project staffs were ordered to cease all communication and halt all collaborative activities. Functionally, this communicated a much different message than one of trust and collaboration, and stalled, if not terminated, momentum in the way of confidence building and buy-in from domestic political actors. This is just one example of many to illustrate how the larger trend of unforeseeable events and political instability greatly hampered the political impact of U.S. programs and packages. And next, the U.S.'s strategic relationship with Israel. Not contentious at all. So now we'll look at how the U.S.'s special or strategic relationship with Israel hinders aid effectiveness in the new legal space. For the sake of background, annually, the U.S. provides the Israeli Defense Forces with a $3.1 billion blank check to provide aid to the Israeli Defense Forces and military. This sum is provided in an effort to maintain what is called Israel's qualitative military edge, or namely Israel's military superiority within the region. And unlike the vast majority of aid packages provided by the U.S., this $3.1 billion is provided within the first 30 days of the fiscal year and with few to no conditions placed upon its usage. And so the tension that I want to tease out in looking at the provision of this aid and how it impacts the legal space is how, without placing any substantive conditions upon how the aid is utilized or allocated, the U.S. is at the very least indirectly implicated in its usages, both in the intended and unintended consequences of how this aid is used. With some segment of this money, Israel purchases F-35 fighter jets from the U.S., which are then used in conflicts within the occupied territories. In both 2012 and 2014, Israel engaged in military offensives in the Gaza Strip with these weapons purchases, in which the Israeli Defense Forces directly targeted justice sector institutions. The Geneva Center for the Democratic Control of Armed Forces, or DCAF, detailed the damage to the justice sector due to the direct targeting of justice sector institutions in both 2012 and 2014, and this is from the 2014 offensive. What this illustrates is a conflict of interest or a tension within the U.S.'s aid packages and the provision of their aid. On the one hand, the U.S. is explicitly committed to strengthening the justice systems in the occupied territories, and on the other, the U.S. is committed to bolstering the Israeli military to become unmatched by any other regional force. However, in instances such as this, in the new legal space, these goals come into conflict with each other. And in this way, the U.S.'s strategic relationship with Israel, the blank check and the tacit expectation that the U.S. will not place conditions on aid packages hinders the capacity of justice sector reform packages and further contributes to the erosion of the justice sector. So now let's take a moment to step back and look again at this picture of U.S. aid. Though committed to bolstering the justice sector in Palestine through justice and security sector reform projects, these efforts are severely limited and in some ways made impotent by several factors. Today, of the four factors that, in my findings, we looked at, the instability of the political climate and the demands of the U.S.'s special relationship with Israel. And given this picture of severely limited, if not ineffectual, aid provision, with the remaining time, I will offer several policy recommendations. First, there's a debate within the literature regarding the effectiveness of pre-independence versus post-independence state-building measures. And my research would lead me to suggest that in the case of Israel-Palestine, post-independence state-building measures would prove more effective than continuing to engage in extensive pre-independence state-building measures. And why I say this is that many of the issues that arise in the story of the effectiveness of U.S. aid come from issues directly related to the occupation of the Palestinian territories and the fragmentation and segregation of the justice systems, and as we heard in our keynote speakers, address this low-hanging fruit of development that in a war zone, in a conflict zone, these pieces are not really allowed to bear fruit. And then placing conditions on the U.S.'s aid to Israel. This is a lofty and highly unlikely policy recommendation. But again, from my research, many of the problems with the effectiveness of the U.S. aid packages come from this unchecked blank check and the lack of supervision in how this aid is used, whether that be in the Israeli military courts with high records of impunity or within their fungible aid provision in the case of damage to the justice sector in Gaza. And so placing conditions on the U.S.'s aid to Israel in the form of their military aid is another important piece of this story. Again, I acknowledge that is highly unlikely, but it's an important piece of this puzzle. And then lastly, justice sector reform projects in the new legal space. Currently, the U.S.'s reform projects only address one legal system within the 9 overlapping and complex schema that was listed on the second slide, and that is the Palestinian Authority's justice sector institutions. And so in looking at the complex web of avenues through which individuals seek and enact justice in Israel-Palestine, part of the reason that these aid packages are made impotent is because they fail to address this complexity. And so I would put forth that justice sector reform projects going forward should address all of these aspects of the new legal space. And in fact, the European Union has begun to do this. So that is all for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Okay, so for our third and final presentation today, Christina Simeon from the Australian National University, a PhD candidate, will present a paper on rule of law assistance and its interfaces in Myanmar, actors, trends and technologies. This paper explores how international actors attempt to translate a development model that draws on international conceptions of the rule of law in Myanmar.
Thank you. Hello. So this paper is part of my broader dissertation research that explores the role of intermediary actors in shaping rule of law assistance to Myanmar. And I conducted field research in Myanmar during 2014 and 15, and I interviewed over 70 local and international rule of law practitioners. And among those actors, I locate the intermediary actors. And I will talk a bit about that in this project as well. I also spend quite a lot of time with the individuals that I identify as intermediaries. So I draw on ethnography a little bit, but I'm not an ethnographist, so legal background. And after 2011, then President Thai Sein and then opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi started to speak a lot about rule of law as part of their new reform agenda. So Thai Sein would mention rule of law and other things like democracy and social justice in his speeches at the parliament. Aung San Suu Kyi has been a democracy advocate for decades, also started to talk a bit more about rule of law in relation to economic development, but also peace building and democracy. And the media started to allow articles that spoke about rule of law and access to justice and things like that that they also had not reported on previously. So this had the result that foreign reform actors, some that were already present in the country, others that were new to the country, they sort of started to set up offices, they arrived on an informal basis, they announced, there's this Myanmar law group where they would announce that now the International Commission of Jurists has an office, etc. So we could see that there was an increase in actors from 2012-13 onwards. And actors like the British Council had been in the country for longer than that, they started to look at how they could engage more with the justice sector or rule of law. And law and justice assistance is, of course, included in my broader umbrella of rule of law assistance. Some of these focus areas and technologies that are being applied in Myanmar by these foreign actors are that they look at legal aid and access to justice, which is lacking. They look at local justice mechanisms and the informal justice system, assessing the different actors who provide justice and who have been providing justice when the country was under strict authoritarian rule and the courts were sort of more spaces of the regime, so they could sort of put people in prison for standing up towards the regime more than places that provide justice for ordinary people. They focus a lot on lawyers and legal education. Legal education has been sort of almost destroyed for decades. They've had legal education on distance programs. So universities have been closed for many years. So now just, I think it was in 2014, or maybe later even, they had the first sort of reopening of universities where they provide legal education at Yangon University. They also have changed the language of instruction many times, so from English to Burmese and then from Burmese to English, which has confused people who were then not fluent in English, but they had studied English, so that made it very inefficient. And judicial reform to some extent has just started, and I'll get back to that a bit. And if we look at sort of a trend of rule of law projects in Myanmar, and that's sort of illustrated by this quote, is that a lot of the foreign actors start to talk about trust building rather than rule of law, because rule of law is a term that has quite negative connotations in Myanmar, where the military regime has used that as a synonym for law and order for decades. So after, when I returned in 2015, people were talking a lot more about trust, access to trust. There's an organization called Justice Trust. So, and as this practitioner says, it's a better term than rule of law because people can easily misunderstand rule of law, but trust is something they can relate to a bit better. And this is just an example of the propaganda from the military regime that you still find across Myanmar. And of course, it's easy to talk about transition after 2011, but society and especially the legal system is, of course, significantly colored by its authoritarian past, still to this day, and the Tatmadaw is the military. So propaganda was common, censorship, all of those things that you find in a regime. People are afraid to talk, stand up against the regime, talk about their lack of access to justice, etc. And if we look at the way this affects rule of law assistance, some of the examples that I find is that when you have institutional cooperation, for example, between the UNDP and the government, first of all, that's a cooperation that has taken them over a year to negotiate, even though the UNDP and UNODC have been in the country for more than 30 years. So they had to renegotiate their contracts to be able to move into the domains of law and justice assistance. And it's often, well, it's formal and slow government cooperation, and they focus a lot on planning, so enhancing the government's planning capacity, and I think that is sort of finding a way out, so not making it too sensitive. So they talk more about how do you plan, how do we make you plan for your reform of the courts, rather than us telling you what to do. And then you also have the informal part. So all of these NGOs and international NGOs who just showed up, just opened offices, and they're not registered, they're operating under the government control, they're providing funding to non-state actors. And there's also a big focus on informal justice. And I also see that a bit as a response to not being able to engage with government actors. So maybe they think, like, what do we do then? Well, we can map the informal justice sectors and see what these guys are doing. And especially, I think, in a setting like Myanmar, which is, lacks transparency, the government is difficult to reach, both geographically and for many other reasons, development cooperation requires the help of an intermediary, so someone who can bridge the different sides and help foreign actors gain access to the people they need. So, and that's a person who's often bilingual and understands both cultures, etc. And for this paper, I talk about the interfaces that we find when we see development as an intervention into a complex system. And in that system, we might view things like knowledge differently. We have different values, and there might be issues of power. So for example, when we look at what the rule of law means in a setting like Myanmar. Well, obviously, it means different things for a foreign rule of law practitioner and someone in Myanmar. And even, a local, supporter of rule of law reform will view it differently than most people who arrive there to promote development. And I think this is sort of an interesting quote of, the values and the things that matter. So if we look at what issues these could mean for foreign development practitioners, well, we have the issue of nepotism, if people like to employ the people they know, because that's how things work. I know that that has been an issue for some foreign funders, because it doesn't look very good if you bring your wife to a conference instead of someone else, or you bring your wife to the project. And also this problem, of course, which you probably recognize. Is somewhere. Yeah. And then we have issues of trust or power dynamics. And then my question is, who is he? This is a man speaking. Well, that's then the intermediary. I am one of the intermediaries I have interviewed in Myanmar. And these are some of the profiles I find. We find Myanmar lawyers, NGO leaders, local staff, government employees, sometimes the foreign embeds that are placed within government ministries manage to play part of a bit of that role as they're placed in the ministries. But still, there are language issues there as well, and they often need an interpreter or an assistant that can help them reach out to government counterparts. And then some development consultants, often with Myanmar background. They have Burmese parents and speak a bit some of the language. And they are the ones that emerge to manage these issues that we find at the interfaces of development cooperation. They mediate between development counterparts when they can't agree on the focus objectives or focus areas or other issues of values, all the things I mentioned. And especially issues of trust. So a very dominant theme in the Myanmar setting is that foreign actors, and someone said, not even locals trust foreigners, and we don't trust your foreign objectives, we don't trust why you're here, and also the people who travel around the country with their development projects will be questioned, like, why are you doing this? Why does the International Commission of Jurists care about these sort of things? They find it quite difficult to be there in the middle, mediating between counterparts that have different understandings of what these things mean. They also become translators, because when people don't understand or they don't view the concepts the same way, You need someone who breaches that business understanding and who translates the rule of law model and those the accompanying technologies that we use to promote rule of law. But in that translation, the intermediaries often infuse messages with their own values. They also create conflicts through mistranslations, which probably is something you see in many different settings. Perfect. So this is sort of my whole thesis is a promotion of intermediary actors, and I think that a better focus on intermediary actors could actually help us do better state building, because I think they sit on a lot of knowledge that we don't know that much about, and you know, it's not enough just to say that these NGOs are intermediaries. I think we need to look at who's actually there at the meetings. Is it the same guy working for the International Commission of Jurists, the International Bar Association, the UNDP? Then what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, we have one local guy supporting all these initiatives, or do we actually have local support for the initiatives? Or it's just a handful of people? And that's what I find in Myanmar. They're not that many. But they're really important for shaping the whole rule of law reform effort, and they work with all different donors at the same time. And I think looking a bit more at them can also explain why we get unintended consequences, why things go a bit different than we expected from the outset, and how look a bit better at how you translate these concepts. So I think we know that this is going on, that people mistranslate or translate the concepts, definitely, but then we might want to think a bit more about why we still have these sort of global, international, you know, universally agreed concepts that still needs significant translation in the field and adaptation to fit local context. And especially, I think, in an authoritarian setting, other settings that are a bit difficult to reach and not that transparent, they are probably especially indispensable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christina. That wraps up the presentations for this morning. So.